Sairam, dear listeners, a warm welcome to the studios of Radio Sai Global Harmony, Swami's God's own radio center on earth. It's with great joy and gratitude in our hearts that Prem and me, Arvind from Team Radio Sai, we have gathered at the lotus feet of our dear Swami in order to enjoy another wonderful afternoon satsang. And today's afternoon satsang is definitely going to be something very thought-provoking and uplifting at the same time. That much I can assure you, because that is what it has done to me. But before we go into the details of the afternoon satsang, it is in order that we spend a few minutes on the significance of this beautiful day. Today is the 30th of January. In India, it is called as the Martyrs' Day, a day that has been kept aside, set aside to commemorate the glorious sacrifices and the various things that heroes of the nation have done. It happens to be the day when the father of the nation, Mahatma Gandhi, was assassinated. In many of his discourses, we have heard Swami speak about the truth-adhering nature of Mahatma Gandhi. In fact, Mahatma Gandhi says in one of his most famous quotes that there is only one God, and that is truth or satya. Well, dear listeners, for us too, there is only one God, and that is our dear Satya. Satya Narayana Raju, Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba. In order to mark this very special day and this occasion, an occasion where the father of the nation and the father of the entire cosmos, our father who is in heaven, our father whose name is hallowed, Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba, Radio Sai prepared a very special audio along with a video for this special occasion. This audio we will play to you so that we can begin the afternoon satsang on a beautiful, uplifting and soul-stirring note. And we also would like to, you know, exhort to you that you must visit the Radio Sai website, because a beautiful video with this song background has been uploaded there. It's on the homepage. Definitely have a look. It's 3 minutes of your day, which is surely going to transform the rest of your day. After you listen to this music piece, after you listen to this beautiful song, yes, we will all welcome Prem into the satsang.
रघुपति राघव राजा राम पतित पावन सीता राम ईश्वर अल्लाह तेरो नाम सबको सन्मति दो भगवान रघुपति राघव राजा पतित पावन सीताराम प्यारे मन सीता राम जय सीता राम भज प्यारे मन सीता राम रघुपति राघव राजा राम पतित पावन सीता राम Thank you.
Yes, dear listeners, that was the special audio we've made for marking this year's Martyrs' Day. And that was, if you know, is one of the most favorite bhajans of Mahatma Gandhi. And in fact, it is said that when he took that long walk, Dandi March, for the Salt Satyagraha, this was the song which the whole group sang all through that march. And knowing Mahatma Gandhi, the last moments of his life, he called out to this favorite deity. And what a fascinating personality he is, and a man who stood by and imbibed the message of the Gita throughout his life, but had the name of Ram always in his lip till that last moment.
Exactly. And for those of our listeners who have missed, we have recounted this episode during our Satyam Shivam Sundaram week, you know, wherein on that fateful day, 30th of January 1948, Swami was actually on the sands of the Chitravati River. All of a sudden, Swami said that he had to hurry, he had to rush, and he just rushed back to the old mandir, the Pata Mandiram, which was at that time the mandir, and he locked himself in his room, did not come out till 7 in the evening. And when he came out, Swami is believed to have said that a Mahatma has left. You know, people, because Mahatma also refers to a great soul, people thought that a great soul had breathed his last, and this was a common phenomenon. You know, now and then Swami would often tell them that today a great soul has left. Swami later on even indicated when Ramana Maharshi left his body. It was only 2 days later when the newspaper was procured from Bukkapatnam, the nearby town, nearby big village actually, that they came to know that when Swami said Mahatma, he was not referring to a great soul. He was referring also to a great soul because he was referring directly to Mahatma Gandhi. And it was pretty obvious that in the last moments of this great soul, he was with Bhagwan. And you know, they say that a manner in which a person dies shows the manner in which he has lived. Indeed, blessed was this soul to have had the Lord by his side at his last moments, which shows that he had the Lord by his side throughout his life. And therefore, a special recording of this favorite bhajan of his.
And dear listeners, we should thank the Tiny Tots of the primary school for giving their vocals for this wonderful song. Those pure innocent voices that you heard in the background along with Brother Ravi Kumar is that of the primary school students, and I believe they've done it in just a couple of takes.
Yes, they were there in the studio, and you know, their energy is so contagious, infectious. It is so infectious. They surcharged the whole studio, and when they recorded it, it was actually planned to be a recording, an audio special only.
Okay.
But such was the energy that we all got, we decided to make a video to accompany along with it, and of course you have penned down few beautiful words for the same. And all this, dear listeners, don't miss it. It's on the website. Go see the video, read what has been written there. You're sure to feel very blessed and beautiful. With that, I think we will proceed to today's topic, which is on the different ways of the master. But again, before that, 2 points we had to make regarding our previous satsang on destiny versus free will.
Yes, dear listeners, before we make comments about the feedback we've got, as we said even when we spoke about that topic, we did take it up with a lot of apprehension because it is not a debate which can be concluded with finality, and that is not our notion in taking up that as well. But whenever we take up a topic, our endeavor is always to see what practical tips can be drawn out of that discussion. And that is why our discussion was not leading to a theoretical conclusion.
And exactly.
That,
so
that could have led to a lot of confusion, as apparently it has.
Yeah, because we had one listener writing in saying that when Arvind, that is me, who was speaking so strongly on behalf of self-effort, it was done with a purpose over here because it was like a debate. So he was saying that if Arvind feels that it is his effort that got him to Swami, there were a lot of other factors, that him being born in a good family, him having received such a good education, which also contributed to him being able to stay with Swami, which was destiny. Completely agree to that. At the same time, if Prem feels that this was his destiny, but at the same time there were efforts that he put, that his parents put, all that come into account. So again, the suggestion that was coming through the whole long mail, which definitely the listener has put in his heart and soul while writing, we definitely appreciate that, was that we should not separate destiny and self-effort. They go hand in hand and they are always together. They are needed. You cannot separate one from the other. The clarification that we would like to issue is that theoretically, all of us know that destiny and self-effort both play their parts. To what percentage, what proportion, we don't know. But the problem comes practically, you know, when I'm faced with a difficulty, when I'm having a problem, do I blame my stars for it and say that what is the use of me doing anything? At the same time, does that mean that I'm not putting in enough effort? For example, you know, often we quote the example of Wilma Rudolph, an Olympian, an athlete who was born with polio, and yet she went on to win the gold medal in athletics. You know, that is paraded as an example for all to emulate. Now, does this mean that all those who are afflicted with polio, if they are not able to win an Olympic gold, they are not putting in enough effort? At the same time, if it was Wilma Rudolph's destiny to achieve that gold, does it mean that all the other polio-afflicted people do not do anything because destiny will take care? So, this destiny versus self-effort becomes a problem at a practical level, not at the theoretical level. And at the practical level, that is why we had Prem taking the side of destiny and me taking the side of self-effort, going on to say that whatever be our belief, if we hold on strongly to that, that in itself will redeem us.
And a kind of an extension of this very discussion is going to be held today, because oftentimes, you know, when we look at how we face our problems in life, whether it is, you know, you put an effort and you don't see the results, or without somebody who's doing efforts in the wrong direction and getting the results which shouldn't be coming. What happens is there are two predominant thinking, strains of thinking which we take to. One is the fatalistic one, saying that, you know, my destiny is bad, whatever I do
is of no use.
It's of no use. That is one thing. And the other thing is taking full credit for what you have achieved.
Correct.
You know, there are some people who are saying that, yes, I've done sadhana and that is why I've got Swami. You know, when people come and question that, you know, why are you getting the attention? They say, because I've earned it. Both of these are extremes which are wrong,
which have to be avoided.
And one is fatally depending on destiny and the other is fatally depending on
self-effort.
Your self-effort. And that is what Swami breaks, and that is why often Swami says one thing one time and the other thing other time. That is because both of these are extremes, though they are opposites apparently, they are actually causing the same harm to the person, to the spiritual aspirant. And that, to avoid that, you have to make sure that you do not give too much importance to destiny. At the same time, do not involve yourself too much in giving credit to a person's effort.
Perfectly. I hope that, we hope that this resolves, because as I said, last time, Prem, when we took it up, it was more because the debate gets strengthened if we have one person backing one of the thing. And that was an idea we tried out. Thank you for that mail though, because it just made us feel very happy and convinced that what we actually believe in our hearts is definitely the right thing, because your mail only reinforced us. There was also another mail, there were also several mails that thanked us for the discussion, and that is what, you know, made us feel grateful to Swami for having done the discussion in that manner, because our idea was, if a person strongly believes in destiny and looks up to destiny in times of practical problems, he or she should be able to find solutions. At the same time, if a person is a strong proponent of self-effort, at times of difficulty, if he looks up to self-effort, he or she must be able to get a solution. That was the idea behind backing both, because Swami has backed both, and ultimately, as we concluded in the discussion, there is no difference, because all will there is only one will, that is the Omni will, and so therefore there is no distinction between destiny and self-effort. With that, I would request Prem to introduce today's topic.
It's a complex topic in that sense, because we are going to try to talk of a lot of things, but even though we're going to talk of a lot of things, we're not going to cover the topic which we've taken completely, because it's what we're going to discuss is not going to be comprehensive because of the nature of the subject. And the subject, as always, is Swami. But we are going to look at Swami as a spiritual master. As a master, I mean, you couldn't even say it's a spiritual master. As a master who has come to make something of all of us. And when a master comes to us with that motive, what are the ways of the master? What are the means of the master? And what differentiates a master's touch from a human touch?
Beautifully put, Prem. And dear listeners, we will be, you know, it'll be like trying to say, describe the skies. I can give 4 points to describe the sky. I can give 100 points to describe the skies. And yet, I might not have described the skies completely. So in the same way, this is going to be the starting of a discussion, which we hope will continue on through your feedback and mails, which then we can carry forward even into the next satsang. So, Prem, getting right into the topic, what distinguishes a master's touch from a human touch? One of the foremost things, you know, that comes into my mind, mm-hmm. and this is something very close to my heart, which I feel differentiates a master from a normal person, is that when it comes to human beings, all of us, we have our pluses and minuses. We have our weaknesses, we have our strengths. I feel that when you turn to a person, a human being, most often what happens is we are told or we are given examples where we should use our strengths, play to our strengths and try to hide or cover up our weaknesses so that on the whole we are presented as a more strong person than a weak person. So use your strengths to cover your weaknesses. That is what a normal person would do. A normal person would advise us. But I feel a master's touch differs from a human touch here because instead of making us cover up our weaknesses with strength, a master is able to transform our weaknesses into our strengths. And that I feel is magical because when a master is able to transform our weakness into our strength, we no longer fear the weaknesses because we know that with the master's touch, that very same weakness can become my strength. I feel this is one point.
Beautiful, because oftentimes, you know, what you are conceived as or you're perceived as is what your weakness is. Mm. You know, many people would like to judge you like that because it's a competitive world. But here is a master who looks at you and says that, yes, your strengths are your strengths, but even your weaknesses are your strengths. And that is why Swami is able to see us as the real potential. You know, Swami calls us Bangaru, Swami calls us Divyatma Surupalara, because he sees only what is perfect and he sees what is imperfect as a passing state or as something which adds to that perfection. You know, that's very difficult to say, explain it, but that is what Swami looked at us as and that is how Swami molded us as.
I'm reminded of a story that I read, you know, of a Chinese lad called Wei Wong. Mm-hmm. Now, Wei Wong, they say, was born with only one hand, only his left hand. He did not have his right hand, because of which he could not do many of the things which children normally do. And he joined his martial arts class. He wanted to learn Kung Fu. And when he's learning Kung Fu, he's not able to compete with the other students naturally because he doesn't have a right hand. Added to it was the fact that he was very determined to learn, so he was a very avid fighter. But he could never be the best. And therefore, you know, he was often teased. He was often teased by others in his class. You know, they would say that Wei Wong has something very wrong. They would keep teasing him and he felt very dejected. And that was when he decided that maybe he was not meant for Kung Fu. Because he had, you know, destiny. Destiny had struck him with this cruel blow wherein he did not have his right hand. And that was when he met his Master Chang. Master Chang told him that if you are sincere and if you are ready to listen to me, I will ensure that next year's tournament, you will be the Kung Fu champion. And Wei Wong is shocked. He is not able to believe how is this ever going to happen. Mm-hmm. So he says, Master, you know, I don't think you know me. He turns around and presents himself fully to his master to show that he doesn't have his right hand. He says, see, you don't know me and that's why now do you think I'll become the champ? And this is where, you know, the point that you made, Prem, the master also says, tells him, you know, he tells him that Wong Kung Fu is not about hands and feet. It's about you. Kung Fu is about you. And as long as you exist, Kung Fu exists. So it's not about your hand or leg. what you said, that, you know, the master's vision is like that. So Wong trusts him and starts training under him. But, you know, to his great surprise, he sees that all the while, the master is teaching him how to defend with his left hand. And though he becomes a master at defense, he's wondering how on earth is he going to win the tournament. Because winning a tournament requires even offense and attack. You need to strike and put down the opponent. Then alone, you can't win a match on defense alone. And even as he's thinking that, his master says, you just concentrate on defense. I will teach you a move and a hold which nobody else will be able to counter. And with that single move, it's enough, you will win. So Wong then feels, teach it to me right now, master, let me practice it. He says, no, it's not yet the time. I will teach you the day before the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Till then, you just practice your defense with your left hand. So, unable to understand what his master is telling, Wong nevertheless follows his word. You know, again, it's a very, very inspirational story for guiding us that irrespective of what happens, once we accept the master, follow the master. So he follows and he learns, and the day before the match, the day before the tournament, Master Chang comes up to him and tells him that here, this is the move and hold that you should do. Once he sees that, Wong is shocked, because what Master Chang is teaching him is one of the basic moves of Kung Fu.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, Master, any Kung Fu artist will be able to, you know, defeat me, because this is no special move, this is a very, very ordinary move. Why are you teaching this to me? Master says, just trust me and use this. And the next couple of days, at the end of the tournament, it is Wong who is standing on the podium to receive the gold medal. Everybody is shocked except for Master Chang and Wong. You know the beautiful thing, Prem, that Wong realizes during the first match, as he's about to lose, he decides to go for that hold and move which his master taught him, which is a very basic move in Kung Fu.
Okay.
And when he goes to apply it, he realizes that the opponent is unable to do anything because the defense against that move involves holding and pulling the opponent's right hand. And here, Wong doesn't have a right hand, and so there is no weakness there. And that move by Wong cannot be countered by any other thing, by any other move of the opponent. And that is how that year he wins the tournament. You know, that story, it was so beautiful because it shows what a master does. A master takes your greatest weakness, here the loss of a right arm in Wong, and converts it into your greatest strength and unassailable strength, which is enough to surpass everything else. A speciality. It could be called the Wong's move after that, for all you know.
I think one could say a parallel of this, what Swami did to us, was when he spoke to the other boys in front of you. When he spoke to somebody and showered his love on somebody right in front of you. And that's when Swami was exactly using your jealousy to actually make you yearn and pine for him, and use that to transform and purify you.
Perfect.
Isn't it? He always did that. You know, he could always, you know, there were 100 ways Swami could shower his grace on somebody, but many times he chose to do it in the open. So that there would be somebody else who would see that, and you know.
And I think that is a positive jealousy.
Yes, and it's not the jealousy of why him or why her. The jealousy was, why not me? Or when can I reach that state? And that was a direct explanation of how Swami used a small flaw in us to actually use it as a tool to lead us to perfection.
You know, when I look back at my life, I feel that there have, of course, been many flaws, but one of the flaws which I consider as my greatest weakness was probably me getting attached. You know, I've had several experiences spanning several years on this weakness of mine, that I get attached to people, and attachment leads to expectation, and expectation leads to non-fulfillment of those expectations,
right.
Which, you know, Bhagwan Shri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says, which leads to anger, frustration, loss of discrimination, and total ruin. That has happened to me over and over again several times.
And as sweetly Swami puts it, no appointments, no disappointments.
Yes, but you know,
we always have appointments.
This very dialogue, you know, people, well-wishers and people who loved me used to tell this to me, telling that, Arvind, don't get attached, because it's only when you have appointments you have disappointments, you know, as you rightly put it, as Swami puts it. But it did not help me, Prem, because how can I not get attached? Because it was not a conscious effort that I was getting attached to someone. Unconsciously it would happen. I would not even know. You know, I felt I was like a root.
Mm-hmm.
The nature of the root is to get itself embedded into the soil and get attached to the soil. It's the nature of the root to get attached. That's what I felt I was. It means maybe you don't have that. You are maybe a leaf. Maybe you're a stem. Right. Maybe you're a fruit. That is why you're not able to understand the problem of a root. My problem is I get attached. How can you tell me not to get attached? It's my nature. I'm not doing it consciously. So therefore it's a humongous effort for me to remain detached. Detachment is so tough for me. And I then thought that let Swami tell me once that Arvind, your problem is attachment. Don't get attached. I will stop it, because I felt that, you know, we have discussed this also. When the Lord gives you a task, He also gives you the strength to fulfill the task. So I felt if Swami tells this to me, that's enough. Because then I will have the energy, I will have the strength necessary to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But can you believe it, Prem? Surprisingly, not even once did ever Swami indicate that you must get detached. In fact, even when I wrote in letters saying that, please Swami, you know, accept this, I want to get detached. Many occasions Swami would not even receive those letters. In fact, I really began to wonder, does Swami want me to get detached at all? And that's what, I will not go into those detailed little experiences, but in many ways, you know, Swami started doing a beautiful thing. He started to guide me to get more and more attached to Him, to Swami. Physically, to the physical form, and to His name, to His attributes, to His qualities, and that began to happen. I was very happy, because this is easy. I am a specialist at getting attached. Swami, if you want me to get attached to you, it's very easy. Because this is my nature, this is my property, I get attached. And I then suddenly saw that as I got more and more attached to Swami, His ways, His teachings, His methods, His form, automatically, unconsciously, I was getting detached from other things. And today, it is with great confidence that I can say that my attachment to people does not bother me so much, thanks to my attachment to Swami. And this is where I felt that a master did a master move in changing my weakness into my strength. He did not tell the root, don't get attached. He simply changed the soil and said, get attached how much ever you want. And having got attached to this soil, no other soil feels fertile now for me. And I am enjoying it, and I really feel grateful to Swami for having considered what I thought was my greatest disability into a great blessing in my life.
You know, there is this beautiful bhajan.
Mm.
It has a wonderful sentence in it. The bhajan is Bhavanasha
Puttaparthi Purisha. Yes.
You know, in that there is one wonderful sentence which is a perfect description of Swami, especially after what you've said.
Mm.
That is what Swami does to all of us. It is very obvious to you because you identified attachment as a problem. But I think without a knowledge, that's exactly what Swami is doing to all of us. Because there is that line which goes, Mohanakara Manamoha Vinasha.
Mm,
because Mohanakara is one who attracts.
Mm.
Manamoha Vinasha is that one who removes the attachment of the mind. So here is a description of God who is saying that He is a person who attracts you so much that actually it makes the other attachments fall by the way.
Beautiful.
Because He's a Mohanakara Manamoha Vinasha.
You know, Prem, next time whenever I follow that bhajan or sing that bhajan, this is definitely going to strike very, very special to me, because wow, now I realize how magical these bhajans are, how magical these lines are. Mohanakara Manamoha Vinasha. One who, you know, attracts so much
strongly
that all the other attractions fall off. That is why He destroys attractions. At the same time, He gives birth to attraction. Wow. Because, you know, without this understanding, if we just look at that line, it seems like an oxymoron. It seems like, how is this two opposite things? How can He destroy attraction when He is creating attraction? He creates attraction towards, wow, it's understood, Prem. Thank you for bringing that up.
You know, just exactly what you said in the Master's Touch, that is exactly what happened in Ramakrishna Paramahamsa's life, you know, when he goes through that process.
Hmm.
You know, Swami has also spoken about it. He takes the ways of the Muslims, then the Christians, then he's a devotee.
While practicing each religion.
Yeah, practicing each religion and each way also.
Mm.
Then there comes by Totapuri. You know, he is an Advaitic scholar.
Mm.
He's an Advaitin to the, you know,
course.
Last cell of his body. And he comes and he's saying that what a mad fellow you are. People told me that here is a Mahatma, here is a Mahanubhava, you go and meet him. and I come and see you're a crazy fellow. Hmm. I mean, you're so attached to a form, what he sees is that of a statue of a mother. He's saying, you're so attached to it, how can you be a Mahatma? How can you be a Mahanbhava? And tells him that, don't you realize that the whole world is unreal and this form of mother is also unreal?
Hmm.
And it seems Ramakrishna is not able to take it. He's saying, how can you call my mother unreal? I know the whole world is unreal. You know, that much I have already reached.
Yes.
But how can you say my mother is unreal? How can you say my mother is Maya? So he goes back to the sanctum sanctorum and starts crying in front of the mother, and he says, the mother comes and says, what happened, child? Why are you crying? And he says, mother, can you believe it? These people are saying that you are unreal. And you know, the mother is in a pensive mood now, and she says, actually, it is true.
Oh.
I am unreal too.
Hmm.
So, you know, he's shocked. He's saying, what do I do now? So he says, go back to Totapuri, he will guide you. He'll be your guru. So actually, in the life of Ramakrishna, Totapuri is one person who has been acknowledged by Ramakrishna as a guru.
Oh, okay.
So he goes back to Totapuri, and Totapuri makes him sit down and do him, you know, puts him through the process of meditation. But every time, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa goes through that state of trance very easily, but every time the veil of the mother's form comes in front of him, and he's not able to go beyond it. So Totapuri gets so frustrated, he says, you know, take the sword of your discrimination and tear through that veil of the mother's form. Mm. And you know, he picks up a small piece of glass and pierces it in between the eyebrows of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa.
Mm.
And he says, you know, tear that veil of mother's form. And finally, actually, he does it. You know, he tears.
You mean to say Totapuri actually pierces Ramakrishna's forehead with a piece of glass?
He says, concentrate here and tear that veil which is coming in front of you. And Ramakrishna actually goes beyond the form, and he's in that, whatever you call, Nirvikalpa Samadhi or Savikalpa Samadhi. After Ramakrishna Paramahamsa reaches that state, Totapuri is wondering now, what took me 30 years, this man has achieved in 3 days. Because he had actually transcended the attachment to the whole world, and he was so attached to the mother, that one word from the mother was enough for him. That finally, when the mother said that even this form is unreal, it just took a few days to take to that reality.
Wow. That's so inspiring, because you know, it shows that though that is the truth, it doesn't mean that you should not develop intense attachment to that one form and one name, because I feel that is a technique that the masters use, you know. They get you from a million attachments to 100 attachments, from 100 attachments to 10, from 10 to 1, and finally when you're intensely attached and when you feel that everything depends on that one single attachment in your life, then they come and tell that, you know, this doesn't exist and take it away. And then you think that you are attachment-less and thus you're going to collapse. And you see that you're not actually collapsing, you're floating. It becomes so beautiful, you know. It's so wonderful. While you were narrating that incident, I just got another tangential thought. Mm-hmm. It's totally tangential to the topic. But I just felt that maybe since it has come, let me mention it.
Okay.
You know, there are many times people who have asked me different things that Swami did, which look strange, which appear strange, you know. Why Swami did this to him? Why Swami did this to that person? It has happened. How can it be? This is not the way. You know, people have a fixed, defined pattern of behavior for a master and God. And if that master or God violates that, they say, how is it that Swami is doing that? How can Swami do this? How can Swami, with that emphasis on Swami, they say that. How can Swami do this? How can Swami tell a lie? How can Swami do this? I was just thinking, you know, if this kind of world, which has a defined rule for a master, happened to see what Totapuri did to Ramakrishna, maybe they would have filed an FIR and got him arrested. Imagine picking up a piece of glass and piercing it in between your eyebrows. It's a very delicate spot. It can kill you. I mean, but we know it is recorded that he bled and he got something. I just felt this thought, this tangential thought, that once we are convinced of our master, we should know that everything that he does is with a purpose of granting something much higher, though it seems to be injuring the body or mind at that particular point in time. I just thought of making this point.
Absolutely. I think that is also one of the most perfect descriptions of a master. You know, the master would not hesitate to do what is good for you, even if it brings infamy to him.
Wow.
And that is something which you have seen with Swami time and again. That fearlessness of a master is only a master can have.
And that fearlessness, no, that abhaya that Swami says, he confers it on to you in the sense that if you have a fear, he, you know, you say, Swami, I'm scared of this. I don't want this, you know, please Swami, you feel that nothing, that fear can't do anything to you because you're with Swami, Swami will keep that fear away. That is what a normal mother or father or a friend would do. But I feel again, that's another defining thing about a master, that when you say you're scared of something, that is the first thing he'll bring up in front of you and help you banish your own ghosts and in the process confer fearlessness. So, summing it up, while a human touch or any worldly touch will try to shield you from your fears, a master grants you fearlessness by bringing your fear right up in front of you and helps you to abolish that fear, drive away the ghosts of that fear.
Exactly. And that is why Swami often says the four F's which Swami gives, you know, for us, for every spiritual aspirant and a devotee, is that follow the master, which is the first one, but the second one is face the devil. Don't hide behind the master and, you know, shy away from the devil. Face the devil. And that's exactly what Swami did. Any fear which people went to, as you said, Swami would make them face it square on. May protect you initially, but you know that it is coming. In fact, I know a few friends who used to say, I'm really scared of my fears because I know I'm going to have to face it.
Okay.
You know, so it comes to that state. If you are afraid of something, if you're apprehensive of something, you can be absolutely sure that it will be put in front of you. But you don't have to be scared of it because Swami will equip you to face it also. And you know, talking of this thing, it's a very interesting thing. If you go in, I think you also would have experienced it. You know, all our teachers would come and tell us that time when we have to choose a subject, when we have to choose between chemistry and bioscience or maths and physics and chemistry.
I remember, you know, in Vrindavan at the end of second year,
right,
I had to pick up a specialization subject. So on my birthday, when, you know, we are allowed that special place with a tray where Swami blesses the clothes, and that is the day you can be almost assured that Swami will pick your letter. I actually had two letters, you know. One letter in which I had written that I wish to take up bioscience and then, you know, pursue this way, do this. But, you know, with bioscience, these are my problems. These are my pluses. These are my strengths and weaknesses with regard to bioscience. Similarly, I could take chemistry also. So I had written another letter, a similar letter, only thing saying, but if I take chemistry, Swami, these are my pluses, these are my minuses, these are my strengths, these are my weaknesses. Swami came during the darshan round. He touched all the dry fruits in my tray. And he saw, you know, usually if people have 2-3 letters, it'll be one letter from their parents,
right,
one from their sister, one, because on a birthday, when it's your birthday, Swami, you know, again, another rule that you put for Swami, you think that Swami can't disappoint on this day, or it's my birthday, come on. So all those letters will be there. But I had not bunched both the letters, you know, I kept one letter on the left end of my tray and the other letter on the right end of my tray. Which means Swami has to definitely make an effort if he has to pick both. My idea was Swami pick any one of them because that is the subject that I am going to specialize in. That was what I had decided. And Swami came and I remember he asked, two letters? You know, because it is not that two letters was a big thing. I have seen Swami picking up even bundles of letters. But usually they are all kept as one bundle. Here an effort had been made to show that these two are distinct letters, you know. Swami has two letters. And I told Swami, Swami, pick any one. So Swami picked one and that was chemistry and that's how he picked my subject. I remember that and I have done this many times in front of Swami. So when you say that, you know, our teachers tell us as to how difficult that choice, because at that point in time, choosing your subject of specialization is the most important thing in life. And that is how I had done it.
You know, maybe before going, I'm just reminded of another incident a schoolboy narrated. You know, when he had to decide between commerce and science. As you said, it was his birthday and that was like the opportunity when he's going to get to ask Swami. So he did the same thing. You know, he wrote two letters and one saying commerce and one saying science. He said, whichever Swami picks, he will take it. But just when he was starting to mandir to go for the blessings, he got a call from his father saying that his grandmother was very, very sick. Okay, and they said that you should ask Swami for prasadam. Since you're going for birthday blessings, you have to ask. And you know, time is such a premium when you go in front of Swami. So he knew that he could ask only one thing.
Solve only one problem.
So he felt very bad that he cannot ask about
specialization.
Specialization, which subject to take. But you know, by the time he could get ready and come, that day Swami comes early and he goes running and sits. So he's in a very, very, messed up state of mind. He's not prepared what he's going to ask Swami or how he's going to word his prayer. And before he could realize, Swami is in front of him and Swami is away. So he's not asked either of the things. And he just is in a state of shock when somebody next to him tells him that, hey, Swami has actually thrown a vibhuti packet into your tray. Okay, and he's so surprised that Swami is thrown, and when he looks at it, the vibhuti packet is on one of those letters.
Oh, okay.
So Swami has answered both questions even without him asking. Swami has given him the prasadam, and the prasadam has fallen in one of the letters which he want. In a way, Swami has chosen what subject he has to take. Yeah, coming back to what we were talking
about. Before you go back, maybe that's another quick beautiful thing about a master. He can answer even an unasked question.
Absolutely. I think, yeah. Thanks for adding that, because that is a very, very valid point. Because
it's not as if that we need to ask.
And we need situations where we can ask Swami. And I think that is an experience of many people around the world, where doubts have been answered unasked. Coming to this question of, you know, making choices.
Facing your fears.
Facing your fears, yeah. And we're talking about choices in this sense of, a lot of our teachers would come and tell us when they went up to Swami and they said, Swami, which subject to take? A question which Swami would ask them was not what subject are you good at, mm-hmm. not where have you done well. Because that's what elders would often say. You know, okay, have you got better marks in maths, or have you got better marks in computer science? So accordingly you choose.
You seem to have an aptitude for
that. But here Swami would say, which subject did you get your least marks in? And suppose you say, Swami, I've gotten chemistry, then said, do chemistry. You know, that is what differentiates a master. Because a master will not protect you from what you are bad at or what you are scared of. He will tell, face it head on.
And he does a very, very good job of it, Aprem. We know of a student who later taught us also. He was in a similar predicament, and somehow, you know, you picked up that same subject. He had his least marks in chemistry. Among all his other subjects, this was a subject that he least liked and he was most scared of. And Swami told him to pick up chemistry, and I think he surprised himself when years later he won the Young Scientist Award at the national level, a very prestigious award. And who would have thought that a person who shuddered at the thought of chemistry would go on to become one of the best young researchers in that very same subject? And that is sheerly due to the master's touch. A master's touch, therefore, a master makes you face your fears rather than protect you from it. I think that is another statement that we can make.
Going to the third description which we would like to give. And dear listeners, just to remind you again, these statements are not statements into which we are trying to fit in Swami's experiences. Because yesterday, even when we were trying to make down these statements, we were thinking, what has Swami done to us? You know, what has Swami done to people around him? What has Swami, how has Swami touched? And that is how we have tried to describe a master, because the only master we have seen and we would like to see and we wish to see and we would like to fill our lives with is Swami. So whatever we are describing is nothing but a description of Swami which we have seen and which we are experiencing in our own lives and people around. And one thing, beautiful thing about a master, and this has been told in so many different ways and with so many different analogies, is that a master is able to see past your imperfections and look right at your perfection.
Exactly.
And you know, a standard thing of this is, like one of the speakers once in Mandir in Swami's presence said, unlike many people who address the gathering, you know, you have these spiritual and religious philosophical gatherings as OE sinners, Swami always said, Divyatma Swarupalara, or Prema Swarupalara. Addressing us as that perfection which you really are, Swami was always addressing only that. And so clearly, Swami would say, embodiments of love. Saying that, yeah, you're all bodies in front of me, but you're actually embodying something which is the purest form which you really are.
That's because he never saw us as bodies having souls. He always felt we are souls who are wearing the body. He never thought of us as people, you know, who have to work and become perfect. He always felt we are already perfect, we just are unaware of it. He never treated us as rocks which have to be cut and shaped into idols. He felt we were idols that have allowed the rock to gather all along. So if once we remove the rock that is not us, the idol stands revealed. That is his faith that made us, you know, what we are today. In fact, I'm reminded of one beautiful story. It's from the Chicken Soup for the Soul series. Mm-hmm. And it highlights this aspect of a master. There was a violin auction going on. And an old, very old, rusty violin which was squeaky and creaky. It had been put up for auction and it was one among the several items that was being auctioned. And as the auction proceeded, different bids came up for this violin. And the highest bid at that time was something like $50. $50 for the violin. So $50 once, $50 twice. Before he could state it for the third time and bang the hammer to say that the deal was complete, an old man walks up to the stage. And everybody is surprised at this intrusion. He picks up the violin and fondly caresses the violin. He takes the bow, he tightens the bow, he tunes the violin, he dusts it off, then, you know, takes a bit of wax and applies it onto the strings, places the violin on his shoulder and begins to play. He plays on it the most ethereal of tunes and the whole auction comes to a standstill because everybody is so lost in this beautiful piece that he is playing. And as he plays and completes, there is pin drop silence. He just gently places the violin back on the ledge where it was, smiles at it and walks down the stage and walks away. And everybody wakes up from their reverie, and the minute the bidding starts again, this time it begins at $500 and the violin sells finally at $10,000. And then, you know, the story says, what is it that gave value to the violin? The violin was the same. It was the master's touch that gave it its value. Because a master's touch is able, a master is able to see past the apparent imperfections. See past the dust on the violin, the creaking sound that it makes. See past the apparent imperfections at the inherent perfection of the violin. That is another beautiful trait of the master.
There is this wonderful story in the life of Shri Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after he has finished his stint in the Vrindavan and the Gokul, he's been called to Mathura to face his uncle Kamsa, you know.
Correct.
And that time Balrama and Krishna go. So they have that time before they go to the court and they meet Chanura in that battle, in that wrestling match.
Correct.
Just before that, they go into the gardens of the king of Mathura.
Mm-hmm.
And there they see this hunchback woman. And she is actually collecting flowers with which she makes scents for Kamsa.
What was her name?
Her name was Kubja.
Kubja, yes, correct.
Huh? Okay, and here is this very, very ugly looking, if you could say that, and a hunchback, you know, who feels very low about herself because of her appearance, and she is there collecting these flowers. But carrying with her these wonderfully fragrant flowers and the other fragrance which she's made. So Krishna comes up to her and he addresses her and asks her, "Oh Sundari, will you not give me some of that fragrance which you're carrying for the king?"
Sundari meaning so beautiful,
beautiful one. Okay. And this woman who has always been used to being called Kuni. Kuni means one who is a
hunchback.
Hunchback. No, she's being referred to as Sundari. The moment she hears that, you know, appellation, she turns back and says, "How dare you sneer at me? And how dare you make
fun of me?
Fun of me? Because it's like you know that somebody is looking ugly, and you're referring to her as, oh, beautiful one." And the moment she looks at Krishna, she sees that, oh, no wonder you're making fun of me because you're so beautiful.
Hmm.
She says, just because you're so attractive and beautiful,
you're mocking me.
You know, it is not right to mock me like this.
Hmm.
And then Krishna says, I'm not mocking. I'm speaking the truth. He's saying, I'm referring to what I'm seeing. I'm looking at the beauty in you and I'm saying, I'm O Sundari. And she says, but I'm a hunchback. He says, that is for the world because the world sees you as a hunchback. But I'm seeing the beauty which is inside you.
Hmm.
And then Krishna says, it takes no effort for me to make even that external form of yours beautiful. And then, you know, graphically, of course, in the serials they show, but we don't know exactly how it happened, but Krishna just holds her chin and lifts her whole body up, straightens her back and changes her form.
And she begins to exude the same internal beauty
even outside. And if you look at it, you know, that is exactly what Swami always did to us. And Swami always referred to us as Bangaru.
Hmm.
You know, we might have been called brats by our teachers, we might have been called insolent and whatever by our parents and our friends. But Swami always looked at us and, you know, in the happiest moment and the most beautiful way Swami would refer to us would be Bangaru. And that is because he always saw that potential beauty in us, that potential goodness in us, and that is what differentiates a master looking at a person and anybody else looking at you.
And that is why we actually blossom in his presence. It's almost, you know, like it used to happen during almost every function. Before Swami's discourse, there would be 2-3 speeches, and the speaker would walk up to Swami and hand over a rosebud. You know, it used to be a tender bud that has been nipped from the plant, and the thorns have been removed because, you know, Swami's delicate fingers should not get hurt. And that rosebud would be offered to him, and as Swami would listen to the talk, you know, it would almost be, in a worldly sense, it would look like there's nothing else for Swami to do, so he's playing with that rose flower in his hand. But if we observe what Swami used to do, it used to have such profound meaning, you know. It has such profound meaning. Because Swami would sit and with the fingers of his right hand, slowly open up the bud which he's holding in his left hand. And at the end of the speech, when the speaker went back to take namaskar and go, you know, Swami would oftentimes hand over the rose back to him. And if we look at this whole thing, symbolically this is what Swami does to the things in our life. You know, whatever we have in our life, in its tender form, in its young form, we should offer it to Swami. Because Swami with his touch makes it blossom, brings out the inherent beauty in it, and then in its beautiful form hands it back to us. That is what we saw as we heard a speech in Kulwanthal. That is what Kubja saw when Lord Krishna visited her kingdom. Dear listeners, we will carry on with this conversation, with this beautiful topic on what is the difference between a master's touch and a normal touch, after this little break. Enjoy this break and be back. Don't miss the next part of the satsang, which is going to be as beautiful and wonderful as it was till now.
संग के साथ जीवन है तुम संग सारे बंधन है तुम संग सारे बंधन है जीवन नैया पार उतारे जीवन नैया जीवन पार उतारे तुम ही हमारे जीवन सहारे तुम ही हमारे जीवन सहारे कैसा गुरु संग कैसा जीवन है गुरु संग कैसा तन के मुख जगा पहचाने गुरु की महिमा गुरु की बारी तन के मुख जग पहचाने दूर तमस कर ज्ञान सरोवर अभिमानी गुरु ही ब्रह्मा गुरु ही विष्णु गुरु ही सबके पालन हारे गुरु ही ब्रह्मा गुरु ही विष्णु गुरु ही सबके पालन हारे
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about those salient features which make a master's touch special. And the point we were discussing is that a master has the ability to see past your apparent imperfections at the inherent perfection. You know, Arvind, why this is a very important point and a description of master is because oftentimes when we approach Swami, we tend to approach him as lesser people. You know, you always look at your flaws and say, Swami, I'm having these flaws. Swami, I have a very unstable mind. Swami, I'm very weak. When a master looks past these imperfections and looks at your perfection, it is to actually empower you and say that this is not what you are. And in fact, a couple of weeks back when we spoke about, you mentioned how Swami said how you should deal with anger. And the idea of separation, separate yourself from that feeling of anger.
Desire.
Because Swami was always telling that this is not you. You are trying to remove something which is not you. So don't pull down yourself or pull down your morale by thinking that I am bad and I am, having this problem. And one thing I remember was Anil Kumar sir, one of our lecturers, Anil Kumar sir, he was narrating of when he was a student, you know, what happened one day when Swami had called some of the students to the old bungalow. You know, they were all sitting there. And those boys who did not find place in that hall where Swami used to sit, they used to stand next to the door. And it's a very informal setting, very beautiful. You know, those who are not able to find will be in the at the door. Some will be peeping through the window. And there will be people sitting all around Swami. And Swami will be chewing paan and very casual conversations. He would often refer to them as one of the most beautiful moments he has been through. So Swami was talking to the students and suddenly Swami looked at him. He was standing next to the door and Swami said, "Hey, what's happening? How are you? How are your studies and all that?" And he said, "Yes, Swami, everything's fine. I have nothing to worry about because I'm with you, Swami," he said. Swami said, "No, there are some problems." So he was a little taken aback and Swami said,
"You know, because if Swami suddenly says, how is everything and everything is fine, I've heard many times this happens and Swami says, hey, no, something is not... You think that, oh, there is something that I am not aware of, something, if nothing is wrong right now, something is going to get wrong now in the coming days. It's right. Some kind of impending sense of
premonition.
Doom. Premonition, yes.
But you know, Swami said, no. And then Swami said, your mind is troubling you. And you know, for Anil Kumar sir, it was like, yes, Swami has, you know, hit the nail on the head.
Are you referring to our translator, Anil Kumar?
No, not Anil Kumar, Professor Anil Kumar. This is Anil Kumar who was a chemistry lecturer.
Oh, okay.
He was a student in the old Vrindavan. So Swami said, no, your mind is troubling you. And for a moment, Anil Kumar sir was taken aback and he said, if there was anything which was troubling him all this while, it was his mind.
Okay.
And then Swami said, bumps and jumps, you know, typically in Swami's style. And Swami said, your mind is fluctuating and it's troubling you. And then he went out, you know, in Telugu he said, it was a Telugu interview which he shared this. He said, Swami, sataistuni Swami.
Oh, sataistuni, yes.
You know, in a very casual way, Swami, it's really troubling me. And that's what he said.
Then, you know, Prem, again, I'm sorry for this interruption because I feel this is a most common problem that all throughout history of mankind has faced. You know, because as you were saying this, my mind wandered away to the time when I told Swami the same thing, you know. I remember when Swami was that time giving darshan in that red Maruti car. And he used to sit in the front.
Right.
And when Swami was going by, I got up and said, Swami, my mind is troubling me. Swami just nodded. And then I told Swami, please control this mind. And Swami said, your mind you want me to control? So I quickly, you know, gathered my wits and said, okay, Swami, give me the strength to control. Swami says, strength has also already been given. You just have to utilize it. So, you know, and not only this, if we go back, say, 5,000 years ago, this is precisely what even Arjuna told Lord Krishna. He said, Chanchalam hi mana Krishna pramati balavadrudam tasyaham nigraham manye vayoriva sudushkuram. Oh Krishna, this mind of mine is so fickle that it troubles me so much. Controlling it is tougher than controlling the wind itself. What should I do, oh Krishna? It appears as if this is man's eternal question to God. Lord, you have gifted me the mind. The mind is so terrible to control. It is troubling me so much. What should I do?
In fact, the beautiful answer which Krishna gives is even more, you know, he says, actually you've defined it very well, but you've left out a few adjectives, and Krishna adds a few.
Yes, yes.
And he says it's even more, you know,
worse than what you
worse
think.
Than what you've described. And, you know, coming back to this, and that is why, that is another point which we'll come to after we've finished this point. The description which Swami gave this lecture of ours was such a beautiful one, and such an empowering one, I could say. No, because Swami told him, actually your mind is very, very pure. And that was one thing which this person could not agree with. Because when you have a troubling mind, you know that you cannot sit down and take an accolade like that. He said, no, Swami, it is not. Swami said, no, your mind is very pure. Okay. And then Swami pulled out his handkerchief which was there next to him. And Swami said, it is as pure as this white handkerchief. And then Swami flipped the handkerchief, and there were stains of that paan mark. Because those days Swami used to take paan.
Chew paan.
And use the handkerchief to wipe his mouth. Swami said, see, there is the stain. Then Swami said, why did the stain come in this pure white cloth? And this boy was quiet. And Swami said, because I use it. Because I'm using it, it is becoming stained. Swami said, your mind is very, very pure. It gets dirty because it is being used. And you cannot stop using it. It is given to you to be used. So it is understandable that it gets dirty. Then Swami says, what do I do with my dirty handkerchief?
Wash it.
I give it to the dhobi.
Yes.
So then Swami said, your mind, I am the dhobi.
Oh, I am the washerman for your mind.
I am the dhobi for your mind. Give your mind to me. And don't blame yourself for having a dirty mind. Because it's a natural thing. It was such a beautiful way, because again, you know, Swami was seeing the purity of the mind, which is the inherent quality of the mind. Yes, it gets dirty with the use, but you know, what a beautiful way Swami is giving out. Swami is saying, give your mind to me. Keep your mind ever involved with me. And I will be the dhobi and I will clean the mind. And that's another point which Swami usually says, not in this context. Swami would say that when you throw a dirty white cloth to the dhobi, you tell the dhobi has made the cloth white. The dhobi never makes the cloth white. The whiteness is the inherent quality of the cloth. The dhobi just removes what is not part of that cloth. And that is what a master does with our mind too, right?
You know, Prem, this brings me to a spontaneous question that has arisen in me right now. How do we practically offer our minds to Swami, our dirty minds? You know, because this, again, is a question that has been glorified even in songs. You know, Anup Jalota ji has sung this song, and there's this famous song which says, Maili chadar odke kaise dwara tumhare aao. How can I come to your doorstep, O Lord, with such a dirty cloth that I'm wearing? So, you know, the cloth of the mind, the cloth of the body, when it gets dirty, we know how to clean the body. But when we say, give the mind, the cloth of the mind, to the washerman, that is Swami, at a practical level, what should we do? Any thoughts on that?
You know, one thing which strikes me even as you ask this question is, one tool which Swami had given, you know, for people who say that Swami, thoughts are troubling me, and bad thoughts, good thoughts and all that. Swami said, see, there is one quality of the mind which you can utilize to control it. And Swami said, your mind at any point of time can have only one single thought. The next moment it can have a different thought, but at that moment it can have only one single thought. So Swami said, make that thought a thought of God. Make that thought a thought of mine. Because when that thought is there cannot be any other thought. And try to make as many moments as possible moments of thoughts of God. Wow. And I think that is what you call it Navaveda Bhakti, or you call it, you know, Namasmarana, you call it Bhajan. That is the idea. That as much as possible, use as many moments as possible in the thoughts of God. So that many moments you have saved from other thoughts.
You know, what you say has also been scientifically proved. You know, I recently read an article which says, its heading was something like, the myth about multitasking. You know, people often say that, you know, it's a great thing. I am a multitasker. You know, they tell it with great pride. I go to office, I have to do this, but I have to do this, I have to do this. I am a multitasker. They have found out that this thing called multitasking is a myth, because they said the very same thing that, you know, that mm-hmm. you said just now, that the mind can focus at only one point or one thing at a time, at a particular point in time. So they say that what a multitasker is actually doing, when you say that I'm typing out a report, listening to music, at the same time dictating commands to my secretary, is shutting off the mind from typing the report and putting it on to dictate to the secretary, then putting it off from dictating and then putting it on for the third task. So it's a constant stage of switching between tasks. Only thing is, when you do one at a time, you sit on a task for half an hour, then switch to the second task for half an hour, and then go to the third task for half an hour. But when you multitask, you're switching between the tasks at the rate of 10 seconds or 15 seconds, and a scientific study showed that instead of half an hour, half an hour, half an hour, a total of 1.5 hours, if you multitask, you will actually take 2.5 hours to do the same thing. I am not sure about the exact time, but it will take more time than it would if you sit and focused on the same thing. And this is really a wonderful thing, because, you know, for those of us who feel that science is the ultimate, even science has shown that the mind can focus only on one thing at a time. And therefore, this solution that you say, practically what does it mean to give our mind to the washerman, that is Swami, is to fill our mind with thoughts of Him. Because if there are thoughts of Him, at that time thoughts, any other thoughts cannot come in. And if we can increase the time in which there are thoughts of Him, I think we are cleansed of all the other thoughts and mind starts feeling strong, vibrant and healthy once again.
You know, there is another beautiful Chinnakatha which Swami says, and He's said it so many times, is that of King Janaka.
Mm.
Now suddenly he is possessed with this desire to attain self-realization, and he says, I have to attain self-realization in the time it takes for me to climb over a horse, a mount a horse. Now he says, when you put your one leg on one side of the saddle, the time it takes to flip your leg over the horse's back, in that time I want to realize myself.
Mm.
And he says, is there a master in this land who can grant me realization like that?
Mm.
So all the renowned scholars step back. He says that nobody can assure somebody, you know, I cannot come and tell you that I'll assure you that I'll give you self-realization in this span of time. So nobody comes by, and I think that's when Yajnavalkya comes and says, I can give it to you.
Mm.
And he comes and he says, see, I will do it to you, but I just need one thing from you.
Mm.
So Janaka says, anything, you can take all my wealth, all my kingdom. He says, no, I don't want all that. He says, give me your mind.
Mm.
Then Janaka says, fine, I've given you my mind. So the, you know, the sage takes Janaka from the palace, takes him into the forest, and one point in the forest, right in the middle of the jungle, he says, you sit down here, close your eyes, I'll come back.
Mm.
So Janaka sits there, closes his eyes, and goes away. And after some time, the army realizes that, you know, the minister realizes that the king is not to be seen, and he's been taken away by the sage, and he's wondering that, is this guy, you know, what if he's a crooked man and he's up to some mischief? So they go in search of the king, the whole army is set out, and then they find this king is sitting there in the middle of the jungle with his eyes closed, without responding to any call.
Mm.
So then the minister says that one set of the army go and find out where that sage is and bring him here. And the other set of the army is sent back to the palace to bring the queen. So they think that if the queen comes and calls him, maybe the king will open his eyes. So the queen is called, and she starts calling out to Janaka, but Janaka is immersed in his meditation. So meanwhile, the sage is caught, he's brought back. And when the sage comes and tells the ministers and the queen, says, don't worry, your queen is absolutely fine, nothing wrong with him. Then they say, why is he not opening his eyes? Why is he not answering when we call him? So then the sage looks at Janaka and says, O king, open your eyes. And instantly he opens his eyes.
Hmm.
Okay. And then everybody's wondering that what happened? Why were you not responding when we called? And the king looks at Yajnavalkya and says, I have given my mind to you. And even to open my eyes and even to answer to a question, I need my mind.
Hmm.
So I cannot do anything if I'm not commanded by you. So to do any act, I should have your command. And that is what it means by giving one's mind to a master.
It was easy for Janaka to say, but it's such a tough thing to do. I mean,
right.
It's so tough to forget.
But, you know, that is the beauty. Again, Swami gives a very, very practical way of doing it. Hmm. Swami says, before you do any act, ask yourself, will my Swami be happy with this? Mm. Will my Swami approve of this?
If Swami is here, I remember, you know, in Singapore, we had a couple of us had been there, and we had to give a talk, and at the end of the talk, there were different questions being asked and we had to answer, and it was the youth over there.
Okay.
You know, my friend was put in, my brother, my friend who was there along with me as a co-speaker, mm-hmm. He was put into a real spot of bother.
Okay.
They asked him this question. They asked him, what does Swami say about dating?
Okay.
You know, if we are having this, this is something that we have never heard Swami physically speak about, you know, whether are you allowed to date and what are the do's and don'ts for a date? This was a question.
And you can also say that none of us would have dared to ask Swami about that.
Exactly. Because, you know, again, I remember such a thing, you know, we would become like Vibhuti in Swami's presence, burnt to ashes. That's what we would have the fear. But here was this person asking the question, you know, what does Swami expect of us when we go on a date? Which means it was assumed that dating is fine, because mm-hmm. in the West, dating is a way of life.
Right.
So they say, what should we do and what should we not do when we go on a date? Now, this brother of mine, he too had absolutely no experience in this, you know, and no example, nothing. What do you say? This is where I felt, you know, Swami stepped into him. And the answer that he gave was simply tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
He said, definitely go on dates. I was thinking, oh my God, what are you saying? I was thinking mentally, imagine both of us, and if you start speaking, you know, I make my eyes wide and think, Prem, what are you speaking? He says, yes, go on dates. But whenever you go on dates, take Swami along with you. He said, wow, I thought, wow, this guy is speaking something nice now. He said, at any dinner table, know that along with you too, Swami is sitting there. And he said, when Swami is sitting with you by your side, whatever you do in His presence, no problem. I thought, now that was such a beautiful thing, to carry Swami along wherever we go. Because whatever we are ready to do in Swami's presence is fine. You know, that is such a beautiful solution, and I was reminded of this because you said that Swami has Himself given the practical solution that whatever happens, think whether Swami will like it or not. Another way of saying the same thing is, have Swami with you always and then do things in His presence, in His omnipresence.
And you know, with the number of answers we ourselves would come up with, and it's not our answers, as you said, these were answers given by Swami in different occasions. For the same question or for the same problem, there are 100 solutions given by the same master. And this is again one of the qualities of the master.
Hmm.
Because a master, the difference between a scholar and a master, you know, it is a quote which is a very popular quote which I came by sometime. It says, a scholar can answer all your questions, but it takes a master to answer you.
Hmm. None of the answers may be satisfactory, right?
Yeah, because that is the thing. That the reason why Swami's answers are different for different people is because Swami is answering the person and not the question. The question might be asked by different people, the same question.
Hmm.
But the person asking is different. And that is why Swami always has a different answer, or not always a different answer, but an answer which is very, very specific for the person who is asking the question.
That is also the cause for the apparent contradiction in Swami's answers. In to one person, Swami says, you know, I remember when it came to the question of asking, Swami has also said this in a public discourse. Swami said, when you go to God and ask, you say, O Daya Sagara, O Karuna Kara, you know, you throw so many epithets at Him, you glorify Him. Swami then said, when you go to your father, will you say, oh, the one who wears a beautiful suit, oh, the one who is a highly employed person in such and such a company, oh, the great father of mine. Do you say all this and then say, Dad, get me one t-shirt? You just go and say, Father, I want a t-shirt, get it to me. So he says, why do you do all this formality with God? It's your right. Demand from God what you want. Now, that was one case. Another case, Swami says, you want to ask God for something? You think you know better than God? You think you are wiser than God? You just shut up and sit. God will give you what you need. In fact, he sings that poem also, Adugakuve O Manasa. Now, these look like contradictory answers. Answers which are polar opposites. One saying, ask everything from God. The other saying, ask nothing, just shut up. You know, that is what a master does, because another way of putting what you said is, because a Lord or a master, he prods you to ask the right question rather than give you the right answer. You know, He is answering you, and He does that by making you ask the right question. The answer doesn't matter at all, because Swami knows that when you ask the right question, that eagerness to know the answer for that question itself will take you along the right path. That's why Swami always says, have you any time asked who you are? Ask yourself who you are. When people ask Swami, Swami, who are you? He said, you will realize who I am. Before that, ask yourself who you are. And yes, as you said, I feel that is another trait of a master, where he prods you to ask the right question rather than give you the right answer.
Exactly. In fact, if you look at it deeply, because the importance actually lies in the question, not in the answers. You know, many times I look at how technology has progressed in these days. You know, if you look at, I have a phone, a smartphone, let's say, you can access the entire Satisai Speaks volumes through that phone. You can access all the Upanishads through that one phone. So in that sense, you're actually carrying the wisdom of entire whatever man has come up with in your pocket.
Correct.
But why are we not scholars, or why are we not realized ones? Because we have not asked the right questions. We have not asked the questions with that yearning and with that pining to know the answers. In fact, you know, our Suresh Rao sir, who's a colleague of ours in Reddy Sai, he used to say, he went to Nisargadat Maharaj. And Maharaj asked him, what do you want to know? So he says, Master, I want to know who I am. He says, that's the question. Hold on to the question. Don't be bothered about the answer. Hold on to that question. Because it's in the question. Because everything is in front of us. You know, we have the entire Satisai Speaks volume in the cupboard. But why does it not make us learned? Why does that not make us those who can actually, those who have got the essence of Swami's message? It's because we have not asked the right questions, and we have not pursued the questions.
I remember a movie, you know, a beautiful movie, I, Robo, I think that's the name of the movie. In that movie also, you know, it's a science fiction movie where an artificial intelligence system takes over the entire world. So the world is in chaos. And here is a professor and two or three, the hero, the protagonist, who are supposed to solve this problem and get the world back under the control of humans. So this professor has to intelligently leave clues which the artificial intelligence cannot decode. And you know, how does that professor do it? In order to protect him from this virtual world that has taken over the actual world, and at the same time convey the message to him, there are little devices which will create a 3D hologram of the professor. And you know, the protagonist goes to the professor and says, you know, why is this happening? The professor says, sorry, I cannot answer that. Because it's not the professor, it's just an image of the professor. Then why is this? Why is that? I cannot answer that. Finally he says, why is it when all that is happening, this is not happening? Then the hologram says, now that is the right question to ask. And it vanishes. The entire movie is built on clues which are nothing but the professor saying that, now that is the right question. Now that is the right question. Seeing that movie, you know, I, Robo, I felt that is what a master does in this also. You know, we are in a world where the virtual reality has actually taken over the reality. You know, we think that this is real, this is everything, money, career, the relationship, these are all real. Virtual, what is virtual actually becomes reality for us. So in order to get out of the virtual reality, it's not in giving answers, but in telling you that you have asked the right question and telling us to hold on to the question. And I felt such a connection, you know, when I saw that movie also. I feel that is, as you said, what the master does, encourages us to ask the right questions. And
perfectly, you know, when we spoke about why do bad things happen to good people, you know, that was one of the conclusions which we came to. When you lead a life of goodness, when you consciously have not done anything wrong, and then when there are difficulties which come forth in your life, of course you can have karma to explain it, you can have other things to explain it, but when those difficulties come in life, you tend to stop and ask, why is this happening to me? Because that questioning is important.
Correct.
And that questioning, actually somebody who has done enough mistakes to justify the bad which is happening to him will not ask that question. You know, he will say that, yeah, I've done bad, it's come. What's a big deal? But that person who has led a good life but faces some difficulty in life will always ask himself, why is this happening? What is the functioning of this whole system?
Correct.
And that questioning is important. And that is why a master, again, going back to that, he will not hesitate to put those which you fear right in front of you. Because those are the things which will make you ask these questions.
You know, we had discussed this on why good is a greater reality. The same thing that when you are good and actually bad things happen, that is what starts this process of questioning. And Nishada and the process of questioning. And the process of questioning is what actually delivers you to the ultimate. Because, you know, all the masters, they have emphasized on who am I, who are you. Emphasis is more on the question rather than the answer. That is because, as you said, answers are many, you know, but the question is only one. It almost comes to that. Swami says, stars are many, sky is one, cows are many, milk is one. I feel answers are many. And we have seen that happening. Swami giving different answers based on different people's level of understanding, their growth. But always the question is the same.
Dear listeners, we started off by saying this, and I think we should, even as we are ready to conclude, we should say that these are definitely not perfect descriptions of the Master. Because he is, as Arvind, you so beautifully said, you can describe the sky in 5 points, you can describe it in 5,000 points, you can describe it in 5 million equations, and still you wouldn't have described it enough. And that is, even this description is not enough description of our, you know, the incomprehensibility of the Master. But dear listeners, if you have some striking points which you feel that this is what actually distinguishes a Master's touch from a human touch, you can write to us and we would love to read them and we would love to share them with all our listeners. As always, you can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. And with this, we offer our inability to describe Swami in his full magnificence.
And at the same time, we also would like to confess to Swami that though description can never be complete, we would love to prattle on and rattle on and continue describing, because there is so much joy in reeling in the description. Who cares if it is complete or not? Because as long as we are describing him, it is so beautiful.
As Swami says, you don't need to drink the entire ocean to know its taste. You just need a spoonful.
Yes, and we are ready to taste those spoonfuls from different parts. Before we conclude and let Brother Chandu take over for his next segment, Love to Love, we would once again like to enthuse you, encourage you to visit the homepage of the Radio Sai website and have a look at that beautiful song video that has been created specially for today, that is Martyrs Day, which happens to be Martyrs Day. You heard the audio at the beginning of the satsang. The video is equally thrilling and beautiful along with the write-up. With that, we will play this song for you, after which there will be Brother Chandu with his Love to Love. As always, we offer this segment at the Lotus Feet with all our love and gratitude. Thank you. Jai Sairam.